now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. Photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today is Wednesday, February the 15th, 2017, the day after Valentine's Day. Kudos to David Icke. David Icke's timing is impeccable yet again. He came out a few days ago with a Connect the Dots video about Donald Trump and Trump's bellicose actions and bellicose words towards Iran. And we must understand, and I'll point this out during this commentary, how what's going on with Iran, the saber rattling towards Iran, is merely a continuum of saber rattling at Iran for decades now, ever since the Shia Ayatollah regime was brought into the picture. So before we delve into Iran and the history of Iran post Mossadegh's removal in 53, it's important to understand the concept of the feel-good messages. That's what I call them, feel-good messages. I don't want to alienate bad pun, bad word, alienate friends of mine and even family members who are devoted followers or supporters of Donald Trump. And there are a lot of people that are my friends, Facebook friends, family members, and they've really jumped on board the Trump bandwagon. And I don't want to upset them, piss them off. I'm just coming up with an analysis of what I see is going on. It's merely my take on these things. No one else has to believe it. But since David Icke opened the door talking about Trump, talking about Trump's hostility towards Iran and his history behind that, I thought I would ask and, you know, add some of my thoughts to the mix. What do I mean by feel-good stories? Okay, this is a feel-good story. This is being promoted, has been promoted by the likes of Benjamin Fulford. Stop me if you've heard this one. A horde of ninjas are going to go out and wipe out the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and every other multi-billionaire bad person out there, right? Still waiting. Hasn't happened yet. Give them time. If they come up with a sequel, maybe, you know, or like what Marvel Comics has been doing lately, coming up with whole new origins for some of their superheroes, maybe if Fulford comes out with another story involving hordes of ninjas, maybe no one will notice that his first prediction about the ninjas going out, wiping out the Rothschilds, never happened. It'll never happen, and you can forget about that whole concept. Here's another feel-good story. Stop me if you've heard this one. The White Hats, in league with the good aliens, and the good aliens can have many points of origin, Galactic Federation of Light, yada, 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 right? For our purposes, let's just call them the good aliens. The White Hats, presumably on Earth, human black ops, human special ops, human intelligence, human rich people that are good. The White Hats, in conjunction with the good aliens, have wiped out, yesterday, 49 underground bases. Last Tuesday, they wiped out 26 underground bases. And presumably, these are underground bases controlled by the bad guys, the bad ETs, the bad military, the bad government, the so-called cabal. Oh, and next week, you know, our sources high up in the White Hats and high up in the Galactic Federation are telling us they're going to wipe out another 14 underground bases on Tuesday, right? Tuesday morning. So we're getting this very specific intel about the alleged White Hats in league with good aliens going around destroying all these underground bases all over the place. And it's really putting a cramp in the operations and agenda of the Draco overlordship, the reptilian overlordship. I ain't buying it. Let me put on my White Hat perspective for a moment. When I look out onto the surface world, from a White Hat perspective, I see a, quote, target-rich environment, unquote. There's HARP in Alaska, HARP in Antarctica, there's the CERN Hadron Collider, there's all kinds of, like, juicy targets for the White Hats and the good ETs to take out. Like, why don't they, the good ETs, just come and make these evil institutions and evil installations just disappear? We know they can do that. When they abduct somebody, they can just take their car away right off the road in a very busy road. Just poof, gone. Flash your light if you're lucky. Right? We know that they can make dozens of intercontinental ballistic missiles suddenly go into a no-go status. We know they can bend time. We know they can manipulate time. And we live in a target-rich environment here on the surface. So why don't these White Hats, affiliated with these good ETs, why don't they take out all these targets on the surface? Oh, no. But they did take out all these underground bases. Folks, that's what's called non-confirmable data. It's a feel-good story. It's a feel-good story. Just like the bazillion ninjas going around lopping off the heads of all the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and the White Hats and the good ETs, taking out all these underground bases. Oh, and also, they're taking out bases on the moon. They're taking out bases on Mars. That's non-confirmable intelligence, non-confirmable data. It's a feel-good story. What's the point of relevance with Donald Trump? Well, a lot of Donald Trump's populist messages, in the overall scheme of things, are a feel-good story. We're supposed to believe that somehow Donald Trump slipped through the cracks, surrounded by hordes of insiders, and somehow he can affect all these meaningful changes. And yet he's already staffing his administration with members of, or quote, unquote, former members of Goldman Sachs, etc., etc. Right? Look at Monsanto. That's, you know, why hasn't that been, Monsanto been legislated out of existence, right? So what I'm saying is, David Icke is absolutely right when he says that this bellicose attitude towards Iran from Trump, which he announced on his Twitter feed, by the way, how did he do that? Hashtag hate Iran, let's go to war. You know, how many retweets did he get? When he's out there, Trump is out there sending tweets out and making these public comments against Iran, that ought to make all the people who follow him uncritically sit up and take notice. Now, let's look at the presidential campaign just concluded once again. You have Trump apparently running against Hillary Clinton. Okay, let's face it, folks. If I had a choice of voting for Hillary Clinton or voting for Godzilla, who is in a permanent steroid rage, I'd rather vote for Godzilla in a permanent steroid rage. So it was one of those elections where one of the candidates was a no-hoper. And we've seen this time and time again. The mummy, John McCain, up against Barack Obama, right? Walter Mondale up against Ronald Reagan. We've seen in the past how these no-hopers are put up against somebody who is likely to win the popular and electoral vote. And that was the case here, right? You have Donald Trump as president of the U.S., or you have Menad Lady, Hillary Clinton. Again, I'd rather vote for Godzilla in a permanent steroid rage. So that's another example where it was a setup. Hillary Clinton was a no-hoper. And also, follow the bouncing ball, if you will. Aside from Jack Kennedy, and Jack Kennedy was not a saint, folks. He abused and he used mind-controlled women. He engaged in, like, sex orgies involving his father and his brother, Bobby, at the Cal Neva Resort, which was all filmed by the CIA and the Mafia. They supplied the women. I'm sure the women were not volunteers, right? I'm sure they were probably forced into prostitution or, you know, sex kitten, mind-controlled slaves. And Bryce Taylor also talks about how Jack Kennedy is one of the perks of being POTUS, President of the U.S., but, you know, while being driven around Washington, D.C., be serviced, if you will, by women in his limousine. So Jack Kennedy was not a saint. But let's take him out of the equation for a second. Because aside from Jack Kennedy, who seemed to exude this image of being a younger, vigorous, vibey kind of president, and a Roman Catholic at that, then you have all the presidents before and for a while the presidents after. And typically what you would see would be some older guy, right? You would see the Lyndon Baines Johnson's types. You would see Richard Nixon. You would see Gerald Ford. You would see Jimmy Carter, okay? Ford was the incumbent, no-hoper, running against Jimmy Carter. You had no-hoper, who was that? A Democrat. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He'll come to me. But he was up against Nixon, and he was a no-hoper, okay? So you have this image of an older kind of president. And so in order to change that image, then you start to have some degree of change, but not really change. Jimmy Carter was the first president elected from the South. Never mind that his administration was chock full of Council on Foreign Relations members and Trilateral Commission members. That's, you know, another point. But, and then he was a no-hoper, and then against Reagan, right? And then Reagan was replaced by George Bush, but people got tired of the Republicans. They got tired of, you know, that short interlude with Carter. And before that, it was Nixon and Gerald Ford, and then Carter the Democrat, and then Reagan slash Bush. So they needed a change. So they bring in another guy from the South, the seemingly vibey Bill Clinton, plays a saxophone, appears on talk shows and does interviews, and is evil as all the rest, of course, right? But he seems to offer a younger, hipper alternative. And so we begin to see that kind of trend where they seem to be presenting an image of someone who's more with it, more hip. And then you fast forward to the election of presidential campaign between Barack Obama on the one hand and running up against the mummy, John McCain, no-hoper. Obama has his two terms where they just affect all kinds of social engineering change. The wars increase. Everything just goes to hell in a handbasket. But, of course, Barack Obama gets a free pass because the so-called anti-war left, who were protesting, you know, Bush Jr., Shrub, they've gone permanently AWOL. And also, you have to look at the continuum from the standpoint of George the Elder Bush, and then the transition later after the rigged election in Florida And then the project for the new American Century crowd, getting George Shrub Bush into office. And who was really running the show was Dickhead Cheney. So again, you have another quote-unquote Republican in there. But this time, Shrub exudes the persona of a redneck, of a yeehaw, you're either with us or you're against us. Now, the only times, like I said earlier, when you had a Southerner in there was Jimmy Carter or you had Bill Clinton, right? But now they flip-flop and they put a seeming Southerner from Texas, George Bush Jr., in there. And so, again, the people that are still caught up in this false left-right paradigm, especially from the left-wing, socialist, communist, Marxist side of things, they were just getting sick of the Bushes. And now it wasn't just a Bush anymore. It was a redneck, right? And see how the smooth transition comes about, where you go from a redneck to the suave, slick-talking black guy, right? 8 years of Obama. And because of all the chaos and upheaval from the last 8 years, Donald Trump rocks up, seemingly an outsider to all this, making all these populist comments, things that appeal to people at a very deep level who were sick and tired of being sick and tired. They're not just sick and tired of politics, sick and tired of the economy, sick and tired of everything. They're sick and tired of being sick and tired. So the populist feel-good message from Donald Trump has an impact on people like that, even people who should know better. Even people that know that 9/11 is an inside job. Even people that know about the reality of the reptilian overlordship. Even people that know about the UFO cover-up and the depopulation agenda. Because Trump makes enough populist feel-good statements to make himself appealing, especially in comparison to the other presidential candidate, Godzilla, excuse me, Hillary Clinton. Okay? It's an important point to make. Okay, now let's talk about Iran. Let's go back a number of decades so we can track the progress to see how we wound up to the point where Trump is going on Twitter and bad-mouthing Iran. British intelligence, MI6, also known as SAS, and the CIA cooperated in ousting Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. He was replaced by Mohammad Shah Pahlavi, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, who was the son of an army officer who became the ruler of Iran and the founder of the Pahlavi dynasty in 1925. His father was exiled back in the day, and then when there was a struggle for power between Mohammad Reza Shah and Mohammad Mossadegh, well, the CIA and MI6 got rid of Mossadegh. They installed Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, who became the second Shah of Iran. He became the Shah of Iran, and his regime was noted for its brutality. His dreaded security service, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi's dreaded security service, was known as SAVAK, S-A-V-A-K, was trained by the Israelis, trained by the CIA, and he was the ruler of Iran for a number of years. The reason why MI6 wanted to get rid of Mohammad Mossadegh was Mohammad Mossadegh moved to nationalize Anglo-Persian Oil, the oil subsidiary owned by the British royal family, British Rothschild interest. By nationalizing the Anglo-Persian oil company, the Iranians would be cutting the British and the Rothschild Zionists out of the action, and of course that just wouldn't do. So they instigated a coup, committed all kinds of acts of terrorism to destabilize Mossadegh's regime, got rid of Mossadegh, installed Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. And for decades, not only did Anglo-Persian Oil continue to make a lot of money from the oil drilling, Iran became a cash cow for Western particularly U.S. defense contractors. The planes that were in the Shah's Air Force were made by American Aerospace Corporation. And a lot of the weaponry used by the Shah's military was bought from Western and American defense contractors, weapons makers, etc. So keep that point in mind. It's important to remember because it factors in later on in the long war between Iraq and Iran, just why the Iranians needed American spare parts for their aging Air Force squadrons, and then they needed American access to American weaponry. Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi was, according to some sources, a pedophile, which wouldn't surprise anybody. That's the kind of person that the powers that be like to prop up, some evil pedophile. Okay, let's fast forward to the Iranian Revolution, because that's when the Ayatollah came in. To this day, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the Iranian Revolution. It was not homegrown. It wasn't something that just organically developed. It had to do with Zbigniew Brzezinski's Ark of Islam. This was an idea to encircle the Soviet Union with a bunch of Islamic republics. And part of that process involved suckering the Soviet Union into Afghanistan. So in Brzezinski's words, the Soviet Union would have their own Vietnam. And that's what happened. Classic operation, seizing control of the Afghan government through a special operation. But through a lot of behind-the-scenes manipulation, the Soviets were made to think that the Afghanis were going to make a turn towards the West. So they felt they had to move first. But it was all pursuant to a plan to get the Soviets bogged down in all of these crisis and wars against Islamic republics. Well, that was part of the reason for making Iran go from the Shah Pahlavi's more westernized regime to the Shiite version of Islam. Because we have to think in terms of the Eretz Israel, Greater Israel scheme of things. From the Greater Israel scheme of things, it behooved the Israelis and the Rothschild Zionists in general to install a Shia regime in Iran. And so, long story short, what happened was the Israelis and Western Black Ops using splinter factions of the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, under Israeli control. In the same way that we see ISIS being moved here, there, and everywhere, destabilizing all these countries in the North Africa and in the Middle East, well, that's what they used to do with all these splinter groups of the PLO. These splinter groups of the PLO, they had nothing to do with liberating Palestine. They had everything to do with being proxies and puppets of the Israelis. They would be used to target real PLO leaders and also to spread this, what they would now call a caliphate mindset, this concept of pan-Arabic, pan-Islamic, global Islamic revolution. And look how far off the mark that is compared to the PLO's original charter, basically. Remember, the PLO originally were largely secularist, Christian, and Sunni Muslim, and they all cohabited happily together. There was a time when, well, for the most part, everyone was happy in Palestine. Jews and Palestinians alike, they used to get along quite well until the Zionists moved in. So it must be understood. You hear all this chatter and all this drivel from these academics. This is going back decades now, talking about how there's a State Department tilt to either Iraq or to Iran. It's a balancing act, and using one country to play off against the other. No. The idea was to fragment Iraq and ultimately fragment and dissolve Iran, just as the case with Libya, Tunisia. They've installed and turned loose all these ISIS, ISIL, Daesh types. They couldn't do it with Syria because the Syrians and the Russians, they made a stand. So let's get back to the Iranian Revolution, so-called. There was a series of books written back in the day by a guy who went by the pseudonym of Gail Rivers. Gail, G-A-Y-L-E, last name, Rivers. It was an assumed name. Gail Rivers was a veteran of the Vietnam War. He was a member of the elite New Zealand Special Air Service. And during the Vietnam War, he was part of an international special forces team called the Five Fingers. There were three U.S. Green Berets, Army Special Forces. There was a member of Australian SAS, British SAS, and a South Korean Ranger, and Gail Rivers, who was second in command from the New Zealand Special Air Service. You've got to read the book. It's called The Five Fingers. So much combat, so much hardcore soldiering in this book. Basically, it was about an op to go into China and assassinate a bunch of communist leaders from North Korea, Vietnam, and China. Anyway, after that operation, and he somehow survived it, then upon recuperating, he went to do a number of mercenary missions in Africa and elsewhere, and became a pilot, a serving pilot with the South African Air Force, while still doing the odd mercenary job on the side. He formed his own European arms company. He became an international arms dealer and would run out his services as a specialist, special forces soldier, to numerous countries for anti-terrorist operations. In the process, he became a member of the 21st Special Air Service Artist Rifles, TA, Territorial Army, mostly made up of reservists. Times of war, when the colors needed to be expanded rapidly, all these people under the 21st SAS Regiment banner, not the 22nd SAS, that's the regular British Army, 21st SAS. These people were more highly trained than your average reservist, because after all, they are SAS members and have to pass through SAS selection. But they're there mostly to be called forth to the colors in time of war or when the regular army needs expanding. Now, within 21st SAS Artist Rifles, there were special units, special troops that dealt with special operations, black operations. And Gail Rivers joined the 21st SAS Artist Rifles. So not only would he do these special ops for the Germans, for the Spanish, going after the ETA, ETA terrorist, and not only would he work for a variety of countries that paid him or private corporations, but he also was a serving member of the British SAS, had high-ranking connections in Whitehall, in the British Ministry of Defense, and in the intelligence services. Well, like I said, he wrote a series of books. His first book was called The Five Fingers, about the operation in Vietnam when he was with the New Zealand SAS. And then his second book was called The Tehran Contract. The Tehran Contract, if you can find it, is a classic as far as a mercenary operation put together by a European arms dealer who happens to be a serving member of the British Special Air Service with high-level connections in Whitehall in the intelligence community. And in that second book, he talks about how he was ultimately recruited. He didn't know who it was at first, spoiler alert, it turns out that the shadowy organization that recruited him for an operation to go into Tehran was actually being run by the Israelis. Surprise, surprise. And what was the job? He had to go into Tehran at the height of the Iranian Revolution, rescue the number two man in the Iranian intelligence service, the number two man really in the Iranian government, very close to the Shah. Not only was this guy dealing intelligence to the Israelis, he was dealing in drugs too. Surprise, surprise. Remember, the Israelis created SAVAK. The Israelis propped up the Shah. Gail Rivers put together a team made up mostly of active duty British SAS and British SBS guys and two former members of the French Foreign Legion who he had served with in mercenary operations in Africa. And he put this team together to go into Tehran to bring out a father, two sons, and a nephew. And this was a family of Iranian Jews, okay? A family of Iranian Jews very close to the Shah. Long story short, spoiler alert, Gail Rivers and his team, they couldn't get to the father. He was tortured to death and imprisoned by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. They couldn't save the nephew. He died of a heroin withdrawal. But they did save the two sons of the father, who was very close to the Shah. And they had to bring these two brothers to an Israeli safe house and have them debriefed before they can send them out and eventually where they would turn up in Europe. And the Israelis had to debrief these two boys for what they knew. Get this. It turned out that these boys had knowledge and access to a number of safety deposit boxes and bank accounts scattered throughout Europe, Switzerland, Germany, etc., as well as knowledge of the addresses of a number of PLO safe houses throughout Germany and throughout Western Europe. Surprise, surprise. And one has to ask themselves, just how did the number two man in the Iranian government, an Iranian Jew, who besides dealing in intelligence, selling intelligence, and being an intelligence asset, agent of influence for the Israelis, who would also be a big-time heroin trafficker? Because by dealing in heroin, the Shah's number two man made an enormous amount of money. So the Israelis wanted that money back, of course, and they wanted all the intelligence this father had secreted away for, let's say, life insurance purposes. So it begs the question again, why would this Iranian guy, this Iranian Jew, have all this information about the Palestinian Liberation Organizations, actually splinter groups, splinter factions created by the Israelis of the PLO? And why would all these secret PLO bank accounts and all this money made in heroin trafficking, which the PLO utilized, right, to fund their operations, why does it wind up in the possession of this father, his two sons, and his nephew? To give a little background to the story, okay, why did the PLO have so many operations in Western Germany? Well, here's why. Because of the national guilt foisted upon the Germans, the Israelis were basically calling the shots as far as how the West German government was formed. And because of the false flag operation we now know as Munich, the Black September operation in 1972 in the Summer Olympics of Europe, in which 11 Israeli athletes were allegedly killed. We'll never know the truth behind that. perception is reality. There was a lot of pressure exerted by the Israelis onto the West German government to form a counterterrorism apparatus. And so rather than create a special counterterrorist unit within the British, the German military, which evoked images and comparisons with the wartime Schutzstaffel, Waffen-SS, they decided to form the counterterrorist unit, hostage rescue unit, within the federal police. This became known as Gruppe 9, or GSG-9. Incidentally, there was a member of GSG-9 that was part of the team Gail Rivers had when he went into Tehran to rescue these Iranian Jews at the height of the Iranian Revolution. Now, bear with me, because this all factors in, okay? So the Israelis trained German GSG-9. In fact, the founder of GSG-9, Ulrich Wegener, was personally selected by the Israelis. One would think that GSG-9's principal foes in West Germany and throughout Europe was so-called, quote-unquote, homegrown German terrorists, i.e. the Bader-Meinhof gang or the Red Army faction. Au contraire, the German GSG-9's principal foe throughout Germany and Western Europe was the PLO. And one has to ask, why? How could the Palestinians further their own cause by causing all this mayhem through Europe, throughout Europe, through Germany and through, well, global strategy of tension? Also, this ties into the whole Operation Gladio aspect scheme of things. So, rather than Red Army faction and Bader-Meinhof being the principal enemies, no, those guys were just patsies created by the KGB and affiliated Warsaw Pact intelligence services, ultimately under the control of the tribalist collectivists anyway. Anything of a Marxist revolutionary slant, right? We talked about this before. Ultimately has its roots with communist collectivism, Marxist-Leninism, and it's two sides of the same coin. So the Israelis created all these offshoots of the PLO, turned them loose in Germany and throughout Europe to cause all this mayhem, to foster in the minds of anyone who read the mainstream media and watched the lamestream news on TV that these Palestinians were nothing but trouble. And that's who the principal enemy of GSG-9 in Germany was the PLO. And so, again, it tracks back to when Gail Rivers led the team into Tehran, rescued the two sons. The father was killed in prison by the Iranian Revolution. And the nephew died of a heroin overdose after being tortured in prison. Heroin withdrawal, actually. And so the Israelis had to debrief these two boys about what they knew of safety deposit boxes, bank accounts, with a large hoard of drugs and drug money, which the PLO utilized, and which the father, number two man to the Shah, had amassed for many years as a drug trafficker and also as an intelligence operative. Okay? Now keep that point in mind. What happened next? It was running in parallel, actually, because as part of the greater Israel, Haaretz Israel scheme of things, the Israelis had to foster in the minds of the West this fear, antagonism, hatred, loathing of all things Arabic, all things Palestinian, and now all things Iranian. This is why the Shah was deposed, and MI6, acting on the behest of their Rothschild Zionist masters, brought in the Ayatollah, right? The rescue of the Iranian Jews I alluded to earlier. Big part of that. And also what happened around that same time frame. During the Carter administration, remember, these same Iranian Shiite revolutionaries, they held hostage a bunch of Americans. When a bunch of Iranian students, Iranian Shiite students, had basically invaded the American embassy in Tehran and kidnapped and held hostage all those Americans. totally humiliating the U.S. in the process, Jimmy Carter in particular. And then the U.S. launched that absolutely bound-to-fail rescue operation to rescue the American hostages in Tehran. Operation Eagle Claw was a complete joke, and it was absolutely guaranteed to fail. So that kidnapping of the Americans in Tehran by the Iranian revolutionaries, the Shiites, really pissed off the Americans in particular. Another thing that was going on in parallel, and this is a point that the aforementioned Gale Rivers made in his third book, which is also a classic in the field, it's called The Specialists, The Revelations of a Professional Counterterrorist. And every chapter is an anthology of the different counterterrorist jobs that Gale Rivers pulled off for the Americans, for the British in Northern Ireland, for the Spanish government against the ETA, ETA. In that book, he talks about how Mossad tried to assassinate him because he was working out a deal, if memory serves, to transfer, to sell a number of French Mirage fighter planes to the Libyans, I think it was. And of course, the Israelis didn't like that, and they tried to kill Gale Rivers. But Gale Rivers made a point in that third book, which I'd already heard from other sources, but it bears repeating here. The first chapter of the book involves Gale Rivers leading a team of U.S. Army Special Forces, i.e. Green Berets, in a raid into Beirut to a Druze headquarters where Syrian Army officers were training and briefing the Druze in Beirut. Gale Rivers pointed out that the Hezbollah in Beirut and the Islamic Jihad in Beirut, in Lebanon in general, Gale Rivers pointed out that the Israelis had direct ties to the Hezbollah, and to the Islamic Jihad, because, Gale Rivers said, and others have said the same thing, it fosters a certain Israeli agenda to promote Islamic Shiite fanaticism, promotes a certain Israeli agenda to foster Shiite fanaticism, Shiite terrorism. And here's the key point and the connection. We heard this over and over and over and over. It was alleged at the time, and for many years afterwards, that the Iranian revolutionary Shia regime in Tehran had armed, financed, trained, and guided the Hezbollah and the Islamic Jihad and other offshoots in Lebanon. Because just as I said that there were American prisoners kidnapped in the American embassy in Tehran, which really pissed off the Americans. They hated everything about Iran. But Americans, Westerners, remember Terry Waite, he was the representative for the Archbishop of Canterbury. He went to Lebanon to negotiate the release of British hostages kept by, I can't remember if it was Hezbollah or Islamic Jihad. But Terry Waite wound up getting kidnapped and held hostage. We have the CIA station chief in Beirut, William Buckley, captured, tortured. They took video of him, supposedly the hostage takers, showing him, you know, hanged. And incidentally, William Buckley told historian and author Gordon Thomas, who wrote a book about mind control, William Buckley, before he was sent off to Beirut, where he was eventually captured and tortured to death, he told Gordon Thomas that William Casey, former CIA director, and then Alan Dulles, one of the founders of the CIA and American intelligence in general, they were both cognizant and aware of the mind control program, MKUltra. And so interesting that William Buckley winds up getting captured by so-called Hezbollah, so-called Islamic Jihad in Beirut, tortured to death, and they videotape him hanging there, his eyes bulging out. And then you have the Marine, Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Marine Corps, Higgins, who was a United Nations observer, part of the United Nations observer mission. He gets kidnapped and tortured to death and hung by his captors. And like I said, that was filmed and videotaped. Pictures were taken. What the same thing they're doing now, you know, Daniel Pearl getting his head chopped off, supposedly, and all these other videos of these woo-woo ISIS killing and beheading people, some of them clearly fake. Well, there's nothing new about any of that. But it goes back to what Gail Rivers said. Remember, Gail Rivers was a professional counterterrorist who held rank in more than one army at the same time. He was an officer in the South African Air Force, where he learned to fly jets and propeller-driven planes. He was also an operative, first for the New Zealand Special Air Service and then 21st SAS Artist Rifles. And he led a number of mercenary missions in Africa, Europe, Asia. And he also had his own company. He was a European arms dealer. So when he makes a point and says that, it furthers in a particular Israeli agenda to foster Islamic terrorism and fanaticism, people have to pay attention to that, because it was emphasized over and over and over by the media at the time that Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, which were capturing all of these Westerners in Beirut and in Lebanon, were Iranian finance, Iranian controlled. Remember, the idea was to foster this hatred of all things Iranian, okay? This hatred had been fostered for decades and decades and decades. And then, as the 1980s goes on, there are all these other terrorist events, terrorist kidnappings, hijackings, attributed to the Islamic Jihad in Lebanon and or Hezbollah and the various offshoots of same. Again, all financed, all armed, supposedly by the Iranians. We have the bombing of the U.S. Marine Barracks BLT Battalion Landing Team near the Beirut airport, October 1983, I think it was, October 23rd, took out 241 Americans, mostly Marines. A suicide bomber, an FBI specialist who came from the U.S. to look at the blast site, the terrorist site, said it was the largest non-nuclear explosion they'd ever seen. Very interesting comment there. Nearly simultaneous to the bombing of the Marine barracks was the bombing of a French paratrooper barracks, not too far away. Some months before that, a suicide truck bomber drove into the American embassy in Beirut. And you had the hijacking of TWA Flight 847, Athens to Rome, hijacked by supposedly Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah-type terrorist. U.S. Navy diver Robert Stephen was tortured and killed on the plane. And there is another terrorist incident, which to this day has been covered up, and that is the flight full of U.S. 101st Air Assault members, flying out of Gander, Newfoundland. Some kind of explosion went off on board the plane as it flew off the runway, and it crashed, and the Canadian Transport Safety Board and other authorities in Canada wrote off the whole incident as the icing of wings causing the plane to be unstable as it flew off the runway, and then the icing on the wings made it crash, etc., etc. Problem with that was a lot of the autopsies showed that there was traces of carbon in the lungs of the people on board, which meant that they were breathing smoke, which meant that there had to be some kind of fire or explosion on board. Other interesting things, in Egypt, there was some mysterious cargo that was put on board the plane. Large rectangular boxes, almost coffin-shaped. Some of the fires were very difficult to put out. The more water they put onto it, the fire was resistant to water, which makes one think of a radiological incident, radiological materials. There were members of Task Force 160, now known as 1st Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the so-called Night Stalkers. These are the guys who fly in the Black Hawk helicopters based out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky. They specialize in transporting Tier 1 Special Operations Forces, i.e. Delta Force, and what they used to call SEAL Team 6. They were on the plane as well, some members of the Task Force 160. And to this day, the U.S. government denies any wrongdoing. Now, the point of relevance is, shortly after the flight, the rented transport plane crashed in Gander, Islamic Jihad took credit for it, surprise, surprise. But then that was all quickly hushed up. Then the official version came in. What was interesting also, a U.S. Army general showed up at the site, and he ordered the crash site to be bulldozed. Now, usually you only see this kind of thing like when a flying saucer or an alien spacecraft crashes, and then the military shows up, and after all the debris is recovered, then they have bulldozers come over and rearrange the site, so it looks completely different, right, than how it started. But they have a bulldozer clean up the site, a crime site, at Gander. And to this day, I mean, there were more people killed on that plane. More 101st Airborne paratroopers were killed on that plane than there were, if memory serves, than there were Marines killed in Beirut in 1983. And who took the credit for that bombing? Islamic Jihad. Go figure. And then you had other things that go on, because the U.S. armed and financed both sides during the long 8-year war between Iran and Iraq. The Iranians and the Iraqis were shooting missiles at each other, folks. The aforementioned Gail Rivers actually led Iraqi frogmen, trained them, and led them on attacks on shipping, international shipping, in the Persian Gulf. Lipatir frogmen attacks to sink international shipping in order to drive up insurance rates for the international shipping industry, because those ships that the frogmen led by Gail Rivers went after were trading and were transporting oil to and from Iran. All right? This whole operation was discussed in Gail Rivers' third book, The Specialist: Revelations of a Professional Counterterrorist. Iran and Iraq were both being armed and financed by the U.S. Saddam Hussein was receiving chemical weapons, nerve agents from the U.S. They were being used on the Iranians. The U.S. passed on intelligence gleaned from satellite imagery to the Iraqis when it looked like the Iranian army would be exploiting a hole in the Iraqi defenses near the key strategic city of Basra. The U.S. passed on intelligence to the Iraqis, warning them about these attacks on these vulnerable points in the Iraqi defenses. And the Iraqis utilize Tabin, which is a nerve agent. They use sarin. They use mustard gas. The losses that the Iranian army, and also not just the Iranian army, but this is the Revolutionary Guards we're talking about also. So on the way to the battlefield, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards would press gang any Iranians who happened to be living near the battlefield, press gang them into the attack, and then point them in the direction of the Iraqi military. The Iraqis would fire airbursts from their artillery. They would drop chemical weapons, and the casualties incurred by the Iranians evoke comparisons to the First World War. 50,000 killed in 1 or 2 days on the Iranian side. Totally beggars belief. People just couldn't believe that the Iranians were incurring those kinds of casualties and still maintaining their war with the Iraqis. Now remember, back then Saddam was a good guy. Iran was the bad guy. But the Shah, before he was deposed, had been buying up with their petrodollars all these American weapons, American jets, American weapon systems. So the Iranians cut a deal with the Americans using the Israelis as cutouts. This became part of the whole Iran-Contra double dealing. I mean, it's just too involved to get into. But then we have to factor in the October surprise, where it was decided that President Carter could not be the president when the U.S. hostages from Iran were returned. So people like George Bush, longtime CIA operative, William Casey, working with Iranian Jews that were intelligence operatives, Iranian weapons dealers, as go-betweens with the mullahs in Iran, they cut a deal. This was the missing 21 hours or whatever when George Bush, who should have been campaigning, right, on the campaign trail, he disappeared, but he wound up in Paris with William Casey and others cutting a deal with the Iranian mullahs. And the deal was, we'll give you the spare parts for your Iranian Air Force planes. We'll work out a deal where we give you anti-tank missiles, anti-aircraft missiles. We'll use the Israelis as cutouts. And we'll unfreeze all the assets, all the Iranian financial assets in the U.S. that were frozen as a result of the Iranians holding all the American prisoners hostage. They'll unfreeze all those assets. All of that the U.S. would do, well, not actually the U.S., but the so-called secret team, George Bush and company. Another person, another book to get is Ari Ben-Menashe's book. A lot of people talk about the Mossad, but Ari Ben-Menashe was a former intelligence operative with Amman, which is the Israeli Army Intelligence Agency, Amman. He wrote an excellent book about all this too, which is very hard to find, about all the arms for prisoner swaps and everything else. Barbara Honegger wrote a book about the October surprise. So did Gary Sick. A number of other people. Lyndon LaRouche wrote a series of articles about it. Basically, the deal was that the Iranians would sever all contact with Carter's secret negotiating team. And then, the moment Reagan was inaugurated, then suddenly the Iranians would release the hostages. And that's what happened. That was the October surprise. They wanted to ensure that Carter was not reelected for president. So those people that are out there serving the system, these are the people you're working for. George Bush and company make a secret deal to keep the hostages in Iran longer than they should have been. And they're playing games with these people's lives just to ensure that Carter is not reelected and that Reagan is elected. And Reagan turns out to be the ultimate cowboy. All the U.S. interventions in the Reagan regime. He's a puppet after all, Reagan was. But think of Grenada. Think of, you know, what happened to the Marines in Beirut, etc., etc. So he had that going on. The secret arms for hostages deal. The Iran-Contra episode where the profits from selling arms to Iran, which was supposed to be the big enemy of the U.S., those profits were turned around and given to the CIA to help finance the war in Central America with the Nicaraguans, Nicaraguan Contras. But of course, the big cash cow in the CIA Contra war was the cocaine trafficking. Whole other story. So, what's the point of all this? The point of all this is that. And also, don't forget that during this time period, the USS Vincennes, a U.S. naval vessel, shot down an Iranian airliner, right? And we're not even talking about the U.S. arming the Iraqis to the teeth. That's a whole nother discussion. But at one point, like I said, the U.S. was arming and financing both the Iraqis and the Iranians. Throw into the mix the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, etc., etc. So over a course of generations, a generation is about 15 years, generations, this hatred of all things Iranian was fostered in the minds of the American people. Fast forward to today, and you have Donald Trump going on Twitter and saying, oh, Iranian this, Iranian that, they're not cooperating. That is very disappointing, and it should be disappointing for those people out there that are Donald Trump supporters. You have to remember the whole concept of feel good. I mean, this is a feel good story of Donald Trump, but when he starts saying things in furtherance of this longstanding policy to isolate, demonize, and eventually what the ultimate purpose is to destroy Iran. Remember, Iran suffered millions of casualties and they kept fighting. There was the so-called War of the Two Cities between Iraq and Iran. There was firing missiles at each other, folks. The Iraqis were firing Scuds at the Iranians. The Iranians were firing missiles back to the Iraqis. Okay, these Iranians, going back to the times of ancient Persia, they're a warrior race. They're not just going to roll over. They need Americans to be boots on the ground. There's simply not enough of troops from the coalition of the unwilling to make it happen. So keep all that in mind. If you think that Syria is bad, just wait till they get involved in Iran. And don't be surprised if they pull off some kind of false flag and blame it on Iran. Also remember that China and Russia lost billions of dollars in investments when Iraq was destroyed and segmented and plunged into a contrived civil war between the Shiites and the Sunnis. China and Russia lost billions, and China and Russia likewise have investments in Iran. The Russia had investments in Syria, and you saw that the Russians stood up for Syria. The Russians will not let Iran go by the wayside, go the way of Libya. Okay? So just keep that all in mind. Anyway, we've reached the end of this week's segment of Bartley's commentaries on this cosmic wars. I've been talking about feel-good stories, white hats, feel-good stories, good ETs, feel-good stories, Donald Trump. Okay? Well, we'll see you next week. Bye for now.